Where your food is grown, what it eats, and how it's nurtured makes a difference. My guest today argues that case not on the basis of ethics, economy, or environment, but on the basis of taste. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Terroir is a French word that means taste of place. The concept of the location where something is grown, influencing its flavor, is common in the world of wine and with a variety of foods across Europe. Rowan Jacobson has traveled North America in search of such flavors. He shares what he's found in his new book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. He'll talk with us, and later this hour, Madeline Sherb has traveled the world sampling food made by monks and nuns. She'll share her taste of heaven later on. You can join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. I think most of us will agree that when it comes to food, particularly produce, fresh is best. But beyond that, the place where your food is grown and the way that it's nurtured influences the way that it tastes. My guest today is food writer Rowan Jacobson, and he has traveled North America searching for unique and delicious flavors. His latest book is American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. You can join our conversation. If you've discovered a unique and wonderful flavor, let us know about it, or if you have questions for Rowan Jacobson, the number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Rowan, good morning.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. I want to start with the concept of terroir, and I hope I'm saying that correctly. French is not a language that I speak.
Actually, you're saying it perfectly. Like, you know, I feel like if we're going to if we're going to embrace this concept in America, we shouldn't, you know, sound like we have a hairball in our throat when we try to say it.
So. Good. So I can sound like an Iowan when I say it. That's good to know. And that is a French word. It means the taste of place. When did you first become familiar with that concept?
Well, I've always been fascinated by how wines all taste different depending on where they come from. And, you know, that's that famous European wines will always be named for the place they come from. And that idea that the place can really influence the flavor is a very old idea with wines. But for with me, I became fascinated with oysters a few years ago. And I basically ate my way across America trying different oysters from different places. And just noticed that oysters were one of the very few foods or drinks I knew of besides wines that were named for where they come from. The most famous oysters are, you know, names like Blue Point or Wellfleet or Apalachicola. They're all places. And that was because people recognized hundreds of years ago that whatever bay an oyster came from had a huge impact on the flavor of that oyster. So I really explored that with oysters, and then I started thinking, you know, could this just be true for wines, just wines and oysters? No. And the more you look at it, the more you realize it's true for almost everything. It's just nobody really has talked about that before.
And why do you choose to use terroir, that word, as opposed to coming up with a different way to say it?
Well, it's a really handy, you know, one word concept. It generally gets translated as the taste of place, but it packs a lot of different types of ideas into one word. It comes from the same root as words like terrain or territory or terra firma. It's all about the earth. But it's not just literally the taste that different types of soil or bedrock can impart to a food. It's about all the different factors that a different type of environment can have. And it also includes the producers of foods or drinks, what the decisions they make in raising their animals or crops that make a difference in the final product.
So we know that this is a common concept in the world of wine. Is it a concept that's also used when talking about other foods in Europe?
Absolutely. In fact, they have a whole system, part of their laws, that are all based on place. And there's many, many foods in different categories that basically have a trademarked brand, which is a place. For example, Prosciutto di Parma. All the original prosciutto came from around the city of Parma in Italy. And you can't call your product Prosciutto di Parma unless it's made in the outskirts of Parma. And that's true for lots of foods in Europe. Here in the States, other than wine, the place you see it used the most is in the world of cheese. Different cheeses, really, like the place has a huge impact on cheese for lots of different reasons that we can talk about. But those are the two where, you know, you go to, for a lot of people, terroir is a completely unfamiliar term and a completely unfamiliar concept. And then you go, you talk to cheesemakers, and they're like, yeah, we've been talking about that for years.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples that you discovered when you decided to move beyond oysters and explore this taste of place with other kinds of food. In your book, you write about a neighbor's field where he grows carrots. And I think that was such a beautiful example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, because terroir is a French term and it sounds pretty snooty, I really wanted to get away from that and start the book with a really down-to-earth example, no pun intended. So, and carrots, you know, I thought about carrots, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's a farmer. I tend to buy a lot of his food at farmers markets, and one day he was telling me how, you know, he had this field, and it was not an ideal, what you'd think of as ideal farming territory. Yeah, here in Vermont, we have a lot of rock, bedrock and shale at the surface. We have pretty thin soil in places, these hard scrabble hill farms. And he had discovered through trial and error, which is usually a big part of figuring out, you know, terroir, like what works where, he had discovered that on this one high field he had that drained really well, that was really rocky, he could grow delicious carrots. They look kind of gnarly. They didn't have the beautiful, thick, straight look of a carrot that's grown in deep soil. But because of all the mineral content in this field, they had this intense, sweet, kind of fresh taste to them. And I tasted a few different carrots, and it was there for sure. And it was because of the place. The place was making the carrots. So I thought, geez, if it's true for carrots, you know, what's it not going to be true for?
How did you set out on this journey? How did you pick the places that you would go and the kinds of foods that you would explore?
Certain ones I knew I wanted to. I wanted to find examples that would be really rich explorations where there'd be a lot to talk about. It's kind of like good case studies. So whenever somebody, you know, I would just learn about one and then I would go explore it further. For example, while learning about oysters, I had met a man who had he'd worked for years in the oyster industry in the Pacific Northwest. But he knew I was interested, so he told me about a salmon that he knew about that came from the Yukon River in Alaska and was completely unlike any salmon on Earth because of the place. And so he described it to me, and I said, hey, I've got to find out about that. So I actually went up to the Yukon Delta for the king salmon season a couple of years ago in June. And to me, it's one of the most dramatic examples of terroir that you can find anywhere, because with salmon, their lifestyle is that they're born at the tips of streams and that run into larger rivers, and maybe for the first year or so of their life, they live in the river. But then they go out to the sea and live in a saltwater environment for most of their lives. But then when they're ready to spawn, they swim upriver back to these little streams that they were born in and spawn and die there where they were born. And when they make that upriver journey, they don't eat at all during that stretch. So if their streams that they were born in were pretty close to the sea, then that's a relatively easy journey. But some of these salmon go on crazy journeys. And these Yukon River king salmon go on the craziest I ever heard of, which is they swim more than 2,000 miles upriver against a pretty strong current all the way through Alaska and into the Yukon Territory and spawn there. So to make that journey without eating, 2,000 miles, they have to have an incredible amount of fuel on board, basically, in the form of fat and muscle. So if you catch them right at the river when they're starting that journey, they're just huge. Huge and the richest tasting salmon you can imagine. If you put them on your grill, they actually set your grill on fire because they have so much oil in them.
When I was looking at the map in your book, you traveled all around North America. You even made a side journey into South America. But there's kind of a big black hole in the center of the country where we are. And of course, Iowa is known for having amazing soil and for being a wonderful place to grow. Did you specifically decide not to go to the traditional farm states when you started exploring these foods?
No, and you know, that black hole definitely has more to do with me than it has to do with the country. It's just the, and my book is definitely, it's an introduction to the subject of terroir, and I'm certainly hoping to explore it in depth a lot further. And I know that the heartland is a key area to look at. Mostly what I was looking at were artisanal products that were kind of, you know, on the extreme end of things for one reason or another. So I did kind of, you know, I was down in, I was looking at coffees from Central America and salmon from Alaska and cheese and maple syrup from Vermont. But I there are some products in the middle of the country that I'm really interested in taking a look at. So cheeses could be a big one there. And I feel like the biggest gap in the current book, which I need to look at in a future book, is pigs. That there are in Europe, they do amazingly different things with pigs depending on where they are, the breed of the animal, the feed, and the techniques that are used in the curing process. And I know that's happening at a lot of different places in the country, including in the Midwest. So that's one I'm really interested in looking at. And one thing I keep saying to people as I'm traveling around is, tell me, you know, what's unique in your area that people don't know about, because generally there's a lot of localized knowledge everywhere that hasn't made it out nationally. And the more of that can come to the fore, the more interesting eating in America is going to be.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because you have really been embraced by the local food movement. And we'll talk more about that in a couple of minutes. But in this book, you profile some amazing foods, and reading it, the only thing that it makes you want to do is to get your hands on that food. And you do provide websites and ways to get in touch. But in a way, that almost seems contrary to the local food movement, because it means that we'd be seeking out these specific foods. Do you find any kind of a contradiction in that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. This I've definitely been embraced by local foods movement. And it's true that one of the most interesting reasons to eat locally is because of terroir. Like, you know, people want to eat locally kind of because it seems like the right thing to do. But it's kind of nice that if there's a more sort of built-in selfish reason to eat locally too, which is, oh, this stuff is unique, this stuff is different, and I want to see what it's like. But yeah, absolutely, focusing on terroir is it doesn't have to be local. It's kind of like culinary travel, because you can sort of tour the country through its foods. And just like with wines, you know, if you're ordering a wine from a particular vineyard in Europe, that's terroir, but that's definitely not localism. So the two can work together, but they aren't necessarily related.
We will talk more about that in a moment. My guest today is Rowan Jacobson, the author of American Terroir. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is food writer Rowan Jacobson. He's traveled around North America searching for unique and delicious flavors, and he's written about his journeys and his finds in his new book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. He'll be appearing in Iowa City on Sunday the 19th as part of the Iowa City Field to Family event. And if you have a favorite local food, something that you've discovered, let us know about it. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And maybe you'll give Rowan some ideas for things he should sample when he's going to be in Iowa in the near future. And I want to talk about apples. That's one of my favorite subjects to talk about this time of year. And Iowa makes a very, very small cameo appearance in your Iowa chapter. And not a very good light, honestly, because Iowa is the place that the red delicious apple was discovered, which is the bane of most apple lovers' existence.
Yeah, the red delicious is a strange fruit, I guess you could say. But, really, when they developed the red delicious, they were just giving us all what we asked for, because what the market has shown again and again and again is that people buy red apples. The redder the apple, the more popular it will be. And taste really hasn't figured very prominently in what's become a popular apple and what hasn't. So now, you know, the industry has kept developing, sort of pushing the red thing further and further until they now have a type of Red Delicious that is categorized as Midnight Red, whatever that is. But
and it tastes horrible.
Yeah, the Red Delicious, as they're getting that skin redder and redder and redder and thicker, it was getting less pleasant. And meanwhile, the flesh inside was getting kind of dry and airy. So the really tasty apples aren't necessarily the prettiest ones. But I think now, finally, things are starting to flip, and you're seeing kind of an apple revolution with many new and really old varieties appearing in the market.
Well, and when you're here, you should sample some Iowa apples, because this is a wonderful place to grow apples. But tell me about the farm, the apple farm that you visited. Was it in Washington State?
It is, in the Yakima Valley. And, from the apples I've tasted around the country, the most remarkable I've seen are coming from certain places in the Yakima Valley. And other places that have that type of environment. It's kind of funny because apples, they're not native to America. They came from Kazakhstan originally, but you know they certainly have done well here. Everywhere they've gone, I see the apples having kind of reinvented itself throughout the country in different areas. It's kept adapting. It's got a huge gene base that it's working from, so it keeps kind of evolving and coming up with new varieties that work in different places, but. You know, in the eastern part of the country, we can't really make a great, beautiful organic apple because we're so wet, relatively, and there's just all these different molds and other nasty things that will get on apples if you don't spray them. But out in, you know, the Yakima Valley is one of the driest places in the country. It gets about 4 inches of precipitation a year. Most of that is snow. Every day is just crisp, clear blue skies, and that's great for apples as long as they have another source of moisture, and they get it through irrigation in that area. So you get, and they also have very little pest resistance. Very little pest presence because it's so dry. So it's kind of this glorious environment to be an apple tree as long as somebody's taking care of your water needs.
It's so interesting that. You talked about the carrots earlier on the show, which grew in a not particularly friendly environment. The apples grow in a not particularly friendly environment. Do you think there's something to that, that plants that have to work harder almost develop a more tasty fruit or produce of whatever kind?
That's a great point, Charity. That kind of comes up again and again when you really start looking at where good flavor comes from in all these different crops. It's counterintuitive. Really, really nice environments don't necessarily make great tasting food, and it is because, yeah, plants have to work harder. Classically, in the wine world, you want to stress your grapes so that if they get too much water and or too much sun and they make too much sugar, you get sort of you get boring juice. I kind of think, you know, like. And I don't know. I guess I can knock California for a minute here, maybe. But you know, people who come from places where it's nice all the time sometimes aren't that interesting. And I think the same thing is true for wines or for other foods. That if it's always nice, they kind of don't develop that inner character.
Well, so, you will get a lot of people agreeing with you on
right.
that in Iowa.
You're right. You know, there's the tough winter. There's something to be said for the tough winter, but. So to me, the most interesting wines come from places that are a little bit forlorn part of the year, and I know in organic food tends to often have more intense flavor, and it's partly because not only are they getting stressed, but, you know, because they have to work harder to get their nutrients, but they're also getting more pests attacking them, and a lot of the flavors that we like in foods are actually chemicals that the plants make to defend themselves from insects. So sometimes the fruit that doesn't look so good because it's had a little insect visiting will actually have more intense flavor.
Randy is on the line from Iowa County. Hello, Randy.
Yeah, he just pretty much answered what I was saying. I know people that buy pears that are locally grown, and they go, boy, those are real pears, not like that stuff you get that's shipped in from whatever state, 5,000 miles west or wherever else. So you're right. It has a better taste. And I'm not just saying that because I'm an Iowa farmer's market vendor. It's just when you get people time after time after time saying, no spray, that's great. We want to hear that.
Yeah, it's that's definitely true, Randy, that when food, you know, food that's on designed for an international market is grown for shipability rather than flavor. So something that's grown because it tastes good probably can't travel too far. It's got to stay close to home, but that's all the more reason to seek it out.
Well, and also with fruits and vegetables, often if they're grown to be shipped, they're picked before they're ripe, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So the flavors that developed when you wrote about the apple producer, he talked about that last few weeks and how he holds back on water for the last few weeks because that really having a hard time there at the end brings out the sugars in the apples.
Right. Yeah. You don't with fruit in particular, water near the end. You know, they certainly need water a lot through the summer, but near the end, if the plants get a lot of water, they'll pump that right into the fruit and just water it down. So you want a nice little dry spot at the end to finish them off.
And that ripening experience on the vine or on the tree is something that you wouldn't get if you were picking it early to ripen and ship.
Right, and which is why what happens with a lot of fruit is they pick it unripe and then they gas it to artificially trigger the ripening process, but that doesn't create flavor. It just makes it look right.
Carol is on the line from Carol. Hello.
Hi. I when I talked to the lady who answered, I said I have just two words: morel mushrooms.
Woo! Do you guys get a lot of morels out there?
Oh my word! In the spring, oh, they're everywhere.
You know, I was just I like to forage for mushrooms, and I was talking to another hardcore forager up here, and he was ecstatic because he had found one morel this spring. We just almost never see him here in
Well,
Vermont.
It was tough this spring, but it's usually not tough.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm going to miss
those. Totally in the wrong season for that. and I'll bet, Carol, that you wouldn't tell him where you go hunting either.
Absolutely not.
Oh, come on. I won't tell, really.
It's a little bit swampy and a little bit crunchy and a little bit shady. And there's water nearby, but that's all you're going to know.
All right, well, that narrows it down a little.
Right, Carol, thank you so much.
Bye.
Well, I'm glad Carol called in because that's another way you can look at terroir is not just the way that the land can change the flavor in a product like an apple that's grown everywhere, but what will grow wild in your area and, you know, what kind of meal can you make out of what your land, what the land is naturally producing. That's a whole different way of looking at terroir, and to me, one of the most exciting.
Jay is on the line in Fairfield at 866-780-9100. Hello, Jay.
Hi. I just want to say that I believe there's a way to increase the taste and the nutritional quality of virtually anything.
And what is that?
And that is every 5 or 10 years to replenish your soil with minerals, a wide array of minerals, because we're not getting it in the food that we eat today. We get nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And as everyone knows, there are 70 or 80 minerals that the body needs.
Well, that's interesting, Jay. When we were talking about those carrots earlier in our conversation, that's what you thought perhaps the secret to those wonderful tasting carrots was, that they grew in rocky soil and absorbed minerals.
Yeah, and that's our hunch anyway. And you hear that from wine growers all the time, that old vines that have to dig deeper into the ground to get their water will also be pulling up more minerals and nutrients. And yeah, what Jay says, I think the science is just starting on this, but I think it's going to become a major issue. You know, most most agriculture uses artificial fertilizer, you know, NPK. You basically, you know, you take those three meganutrients and you just pump it into the soil and create these plants out of them, and it works. But is that plant the same thing as it is if it's not getting artificial fertilizer and it's drawing all these other micronutrients and minerals into it that we're not pumping in because we kind of didn't understand that that was part of the equation?
I want to talk for a moment about honey, because you write about a specific honey producer who has really narrowed down the different places that her bees are collecting honey, and she collects samples from all over the world. What's special about where bees collect their pollen in making honey?
Well, honey is another really fascinating one to talk about, because we talk about honey as if it's one thing, but really it's a whole category of foods, kind of like fruit, because honey is concentrated nectar. It's like a syrup made out of nectar. And nectar is this sugar water that plants give away in their flowers for the purpose of getting the bees to visit and pollinate them. And, you know, that sugar water, it'll have 10 or 15% sugar in it. It's kind of like fruit juice. But it'll also have all these other flavor compounds in it, depending on the type of plant. And so if bees make a honey out of just that one type of plant, it'll be really distinctive. And you'll see varietal honeys for sale in farmers markets all over the country. In Florida, you'll get like an orange blossom honey, which truly, it's amazing. It tastes like you're wandering through an orange grove. And then you might get an acacia honey or a goldenrod honey or an apple honey. Blueberry honey is one of the most sought after. They're all completely different. They don't necessarily taste like the fruit of that plant, but some of them do. Blueberry does. If you taste a blueberry honey, you can definitely get a clear blueberry note in there, which is pretty exciting.
And so the honey must change over the season.
Absolutely. And because bees will change their nectar source throughout the year. And generally, if they're just foraging in the wild, they're going to be pulling from all kinds of different plants and getting all kinds of different flavors in the honey. And that's why it'll generally just be called wildflower honey or clover honey. If you see clover honey, you know, those bees weren't interviewed. They weren't debriefed on their missions if they came back into the hive where, you know, which plants did you hit. It's basically clover is just kind of covering
the generic term.
Yeah, like probably a lot of it was clover, but there's a lot of other stuff mixed in there too. But because beekeepers are also hired for pollination jobs, where the, you know, like the almond growers in California will have the beekeepers bring their hives into the almond groves to pollinate those trees. And in that kind of situation, the bees don't have anything else to work with. You know, they're in the middle of mile after mile of almond orchard. So the honey that they make there will be entirely from that one source. And that's how you get a real varietal honey.
Chris is on the line. Hello, Chris.
Yes, I'm in Illinois. I just made a circuit of the state from the Missouri border, and I passed through the Quad Cities. And I thought of the Muscatine melon as a distinctive, Iowa product that might be worth looking at and compared to other varieties of melon.
That's a great suggestion. It's funny, I grew up eating musk melons and never understood that musk was short for muscatine, and that was a unique Iowan product. Chris is no longer on the line, but maybe you should. They're kind of out of season now, but there are probably a few left around. At the peak of the season, they're everywhere, and they are wonderful.
Now, so how would you describe the flavor as compared to other melons? Does it have a muskiness to it?
You know, no, it doesn't. It's just named for the place.
Okay.
It's a muscatine. It's just short.
Okay.
Before we let you go today, though, I want to ask you, obviously, again, the flavors that you describe in your book are so compelling, and especially when you were writing about the honey, it made me want to get my hands on that specific honey. But beyond that, what are you hoping people will take away from American terroir?
I'm glad you asked that, because, I mean, yeah, it's really fun to just be able to taste different places in this way. But to me, it's more than that, I think. You know, if you look across America, we have this whole creeping sprawl factor, where more and more places are sort of losing their identity and becoming kind of placeless, right? They look just like the strips and the housing developments that you see anywhere else. And to me, if you, you know, start to appreciate terroir, appreciate the unique things that different places on, in the country, different agricultural landscapes can do, then you become more attached to those places. They sort of have an identity that can't be taken away from them so easily, or that will at least fight to prevent from being taken away from them. So to me, it kind of is this antithesis to the meaninglessness of sprawl, in that it helps you see the identity of the places all across America.
Rowan, could you stay with us for a little while?
Absolutely.
All right. We will continue our conversation more after a break. Rowan Jacobson is the author of American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. He'll be appearing in Iowa City coming up on Sunday the 19th as part of the Iowa City Field to Family event. He'll be at the Iowa City Public Library on Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. And we would love to find out about your favorite local food finds. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me right now is Rowan Jacobson. He's the author of American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. And Rowan, before I let you go, what do you think local food producers can learn from the concept of terroir, of the concept of the taste of place?
Well, you know, one thing I've noticed talking with people about this over the past couple of years is that people just are fascinated. They love to pay attention. They're slightly intimidated because, you know, the wine writers of the world have kind of done a great job of intimidating us about talking about taste and flavor. You know, when they talk about pencil shavings and you know, blackberry notes in wine. But people love to, you know, talk about foods, just simple foods, and what they taste like and why they taste like that. And I think farmers can. I think that need, that interest, isn't really being met in a lot of different food areas, and farmers shouldn't hesitate to sort of chat that up with people and explain more about the process of how they. Farmers often assume that people aren't interested in what they like, the decisions they had to make to get their food to taste really great, but I find that people are really interested and just love to hear, to sort of open up the hood and take a look at how it all works.
Rowan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Rowan Jacobson is the author of American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields, and he will be in Iowa City on Sunday the 19th as part of the Iowa City Field to Family event. Now joining me is Madeline Sherb, and she's been also traveling the world seeking out unique flavors. She has visited monasteries and abbeys the world over, tasting the foods and drinks prepared by monks and nuns. And one of the abbeys that she visited is the Our Lady of the Mississippi Abbey, which is near Dubuque. Madeline, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
What made you decide to set off on this quest?
Everybody asks me that. I was living and working in New York City, and sometime around 9/11, I started to really question if I was doing what I wanted to be doing with my life. And I had been a working journalist prior to 9/11, but then I went into PR. I like to say that I crossed over to the dark side and did PR for a while. And I just wasn't really happy on a lot of different levels. And that day changed a lot of things for a lot of people. And I decided to just completely change my life. So I sold my home and I left my job and I embarked on this journey to the monasteries.
Why monasteries? What was it about the idea of visiting these places that appealed to you?
Well, you know, that's such a good question, because I think when I started writing the book, I had never actually been to a monastery. So it's easier for me to answer that now, looking back, and say that For me, it really was a spiritual pilgrimage. It wasn't just about the food. The food, to me, is a way of talking to people about something, you know, something bigger than food. But food is a very fun way to approach people to get them thinking about the bigger questions in life. So the monasteries turned out to be, for me, just wonderful, wonderful places spiritually, and the food they make is really, really wonderful.
Why are there so many foods and specialty foods made at monasteries and abbeys?
Well, that's another great question, because it turns out that a lot of monasteries are making food for sale. Because, first of all, I should point out that all of the monasteries in this book are contemplative monasteries, meaning that they live to pray. Prayer is their reason for being. So the rest of their day is structured around their prayer life. So they pray seven times a day, and they have a shift where they go to work. So once a day during the day, they go to work, and that work shift is usually used to make a product that they can sell to support their monastery. So these monks and nuns are mostly silent. They live They live their lives in silence. They work in silence. I really enjoyed that. I got on the assembly line at Our Lady of the Mississippi Abbey and helped make caramels. And I love that you can work in silence, and everybody's working towards the same goal. And work for them is really a form of prayer. So it's just a very interesting way to rethink work and the nature of work and why we work and what's the purpose of it all.
Does the fact that the focus of life at these places is prayer, not the food that's being prepared, but
right,
the life of prayer, does that influence the kinds of foods that they can and do prepare?
Yes. That's exactly what determines the kinds of products that they can make. So what happened is a lot of monasteries tried other things. They almost all once were farming, and for centuries and centuries, even for, you know, 1,000 years, they've been farmers and self-supporting as farmers, and they would sell extra cheese or beer or wine, whatever their abbey had a surplus of. They would sell it to travelers along the pilgrim routes. So now, if you fast forward 1,000 years to, you know, to our time, some of them found that farming wasn't profitable. They started making things like candy and chocolate. The one thing that all of their food products and drink products have in common is usually they require some downtime. And by that, I mean fermentation. If you think about cheese, it requires some time to mature. If you think about beer, it requires some time to ferment. So that fermentation actually is a very nice fit for their prayer life. And also, the infamous Abbey food product, fruitcake, is really the perfect example, because fruitcake has a shelf life that it actually needs a shelf life. It actually has to age before they can sell it. So the fact that the product can sit for a while they continue, you know, doing their seven prayers a day, it has to fit around their prayer schedule.
So prayer is the priority, clearly, but these food products, all of the ones that you described in your book, are absolutely wonderful and popular. People want to get their hands on them. So how does the business model part of this work into that life of prayer?
Well, you know, it's so interesting, because the monks and nuns, they taught me so much. They taught me they never do anything halfway. They give everything their best effort every single day. And they approach the food products that they make the same way, because they're doing it for God. They're never working for profit. Profit is never, ever, ever the motive. They only earn enough to support their abbeys, and the rest goes to charity. So it's a really interesting way to make these food products. And people who want to get their hands on these products, I think, can find a shopping guide that I included in the book, because so many people want to try these products but, you know, think that it's hard to get their hands on them. It used to be harder, in the sense that you really had to go to a monastery gift shop to get your hands on the, you know, the caramels from Our Lady of the Mississippi, or the fudge from Holy Spirit, or, you know, the fruitcake from Guadalupe. now you can really get almost everything online. They've gone online in just about the past 5 years. So some of their websites are very humble. Some of their websites, you know, they're a little bit simple yet. They're not fancy websites, but you can order online now.
If you have a question for Madeline Sherb, she's the author of A Taste of Heaven, A Guide to Food and Drink Made by Monks and Nuns, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Maybe you've had an experience of tasting the food made at a monastery or an abbey that you'd like to share with us. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. And I want to talk about the Our Lady of the Mississippi Abbey. It is in Dubuque. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that abbey?
Yes, well, it was founded by nuns from Mount St. Mary's, which is a monastery in Massachusetts, and those nuns originally came to the United States from Ireland. And if I'm not mistaken, it was the first Cistercian nun foundation in the United States, Mount St. Mary's. And then Mount St. Mary's Foundation was Our Lady of the Mississippi in Iowa. And interestingly enough, I love how this works, Our Lady of the Mississippi now has a foundation of its own. They sent some nuns to Norway because the Queen of Norway, after something like, I forget, hundreds and hundreds of years of the monasteries being absent from Norway, she invited them to bring monasteries back to Norway. And so Iowa sent nuns to Norway, where they now have a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful monastery.
What
so
is
it kind of goes full circle.
What is Our Lady of the Mississippi like?
Oh, well, my goodness. Have you not been there?
I have not been there.
You must go. If you're in Iowa, you must go. It is, you know, I say this about every monastery every time I get to one. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth. And there's just something about a monastery that I think is just really, it's like an Iowa grandmother who I write about in the book. She said, I feel like I'm on hallowed ground every time I come to Our Lady of the Mississippi. And you really feel that when you're there. It's a sense of peace that, it's just a profound sense of peace. It's in a beautiful part of Iowa. It has rolling hills, and you're right. You can see the Mississippi River down below because you're elevated. And it's just got woods and the river, and, oh, I mean, it's just so beautiful. And if I understand correctly, that part of Iowa was settled in part by people from Luxembourg. And I think it's Luxembourg, and they built little stone houses. So one of the guest houses that guests can stay at on retreat at Our Lady of the Mississippi is this absolutely adorable little stone house. I mean, you're hardly, it's hardly ascetic, if you know what I mean. It's a beautiful place.
And they specialize in Carmel. Why Carmel?
Yeah. Well, the Carmels, that's a bit of just a stroke of luck, if you ask me, because I happen to love Carmels. So they got the Carmel recipe from their mother house, Mount St. Mary's, which also specializes in candy and makes a variety of kinds of candy. They make chocolate and nut candies and all kinds of things at Mount St. Mary's. When the nuns went to Iowa to start their new foundation, they took a Carmel recipe along, and they've been making Carmels and specializing in that ever since. And when I started writing my book, I did all this research on monasteries all around the world that were making food, and the very first one that I chose to visit, the very first monastery I ever set foot at, was Our Lady of the Mississippi, because I love Carmels.
So when we think about the lives of monks and nuns and, you know, a life of quiet prayer and not based on material goods, it doesn't seem congruent to think about making sweets, really decadent desserts. Is there any kind of a contradiction there?
Yes, it's a very good question. A lot of people wonder about that. How do they end up making things like beer and, you know, and chartreuse liqueur, which is so strong that it will simply knock your socks off? Well, it's very interesting. they rarely indulge in what they make. So what they make to the absolutely highest standards of quality and taste, but they don't overindulge in them themselves. And actually, the rule of Saint Benedict, which most of the monasteries in this book follow, the rule says that a monk, you know, and that also includes nuns, should never overindulge. So overeating, overdrinking, anything like that is not okay for a monk or a nun as a way of life. It's actually written into the rule that they follow. And the rule is a very lovely, balanced rule. It's not too harsh. It's strict, but as Saint Benedict says, if the rule is strict, it's only for the sake of love. So I find that if you read the rule, it's a very balanced guide to a way to live your life. So they make some products that I guess you might call decadent. I prefer to call them divine, but they don't tend to eat them. They are allowed, for example, at the abbeys that make beer, they are allowed to have the beer once, I think it's once a week, and some of the monks will have a beer, but most of them will abstain. There's nothing overly ascetic about it now. They used to be more ascetic, you know, they used to eat really almost just sort of broth and bread, you know, especially during fasts. That's all that they would eat. But nowadays, it's a little more relaxed.
In your book,
you can have a caramel if you want to.
Right. Well, that's good to know. If in your book, you include recipes that you can make with all of the different foods that you describe. Where did you get these recipes?
Well, I'm a rather humble cook, so I knew that, you know, what I wanted to do, my goal with including recipes was I wanted to encourage people every way that I can to buy these products from the monks and nuns to help support their way of life. So I thought, well, you know, if I put some recipes into the book, then people will have to buy those ingredients. So each of the recipes uses an ingredient from a monastery. And then I said to myself, you know, I had worked in PR for many years as well as journalism, and I said, well, I'm not a great cook. Why don't I turn to the real cooks, you know, the real chefs who know how to come up with good recipes using these ingredients? So I have to say some chefs, out of the goodness of their hearts, donated recipes, including a monastery ingredient, and there were chefs who just, you know, they just did an outstanding job. Like Charlie Trotter from Chicago, he created a recipe for this book. And so you won't find that recipe anywhere but this book. And Rick Bayless gave me permission to adapt one of his recipes. Just an extraordinary chef with really good hearts helped to come up with the recipes.
Well, Madeline, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Madeline Sherb is the author of A Taste of Heaven, A Guide to Food and Drink Made by Monks and Nuns, and she writes about the caramels made at Our Lady of the Mississippi outside of Dubuque. You can find links to information about her and her book and also our first guest today, Rowan Jacobson, on our Twitter account at IPR Talk. You can also find more information on our Facebook page. Search for Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at all times at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow, wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here, and we'll do the shuffle. We'll talk about fall migration patterns. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.